Do you like conversation on a variety of topics? Feel like no one wants to talk about the things that interest you? Tired of only hearing the same political, sports, or catastrophe talk? Yeah, we feel that way too. Join two high-functioning geeks as they discuss just about anything under the sun. We can't tell you what we'll be talking about each week because we don't know where our brains will take us. It will be an interesting conversation, though, so hang on and join us. Here comes the Relentless Geekery.
All right, well, hey, welcome, Alan. While we get started, okay. We have a few topics, and knowing us, we'll just jabber forever and forget what we really wanted to accomplish.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm joyful about this, is how the connections are made without us always realizing, okay, that makes sense that it connects, but I think I love that nature of conversation, that it's not stay on topic, you know, we're not political messaging, we're having a good time. So
There we go, exactly.
Was that Dustin, I think? Okay. I'm trying to...
Yeah, that was Colin. Yeah, he's got work later. Okay. So, Alan, how has your week been? What's been happening? I know what's been happening.
Everything's fine. You know what I mean? Kind of like a check-in call with the parents. You know, a lot of nowadays is, well, we're still safe and, you know, I'm still wearing the mask and I've made the least number of provisioning runs that I've had due to interact with people. I'm happy. I took a big hit in the market, I think last Friday or this Monday or something like that, and I'm already recovering nicely. So I know that's one of the things that we were going to talk about, is that I'm taking a pretty geeky approach to investing nowadays, and I'm being pretty successful at it, you know. So if that's something that people might be interested in, it's nice to have a nice story to tell, you know what I mean? So I'm happy.
What we should do is get a little jingle, like to introduce, you know, new topic and bling, something plays.
There you go.
So that was topic number one, investing. That came up. So why don't you talk to me? Because I don't do much investing. I have a small portfolio. I add a little bit to it. I tell them, let it ride. Yeah. I use Acorn and Stash a little bit, put some money in there, let it go to some tech companies. But I'm not heavily following it. And I know a few people like you that do. And in fact, you went to something associated with that this week. So
exactly.
Let's chat. Maybe I'll learn something.
So I don't know, a quick story. You know, when I first started working, I knew that the right way to do it was to save into your 401k and invest in an index fund and let the market work for you and so forth. And that's what I did for a long time, is not be an active investor, but just know that saving is key, investing is key, and that the way that you'll win is time value of money. You know, so if you're starting, I started working when I was 23 after I got out of college with a couple of degrees, and I did all that. But then if you have setbacks in your life, you go through a divorce or you get a medical expenses, you know, disaster or something like that, a lot of what I had made over the course of time has been drained, spent on the appropriate things. And Colleen and I got to a place recently where, okay, you know, we're looking at retirement. How are we doing for retirement? And is there any way to accelerate us being able to retire, to have more money when we do retire, those kinds of things? One of the big lessons that I've learned from, and actually, this is a quick digression. At one point, I was very actively involved because I was developing trading systems using artificial intelligence. And so I did a whole bunch of study of various different things and was doing well without actually being in the market. It was all testing. It was all developing the system that would do it. And then it turned out, unfortunately, that I got associated with people that weren't that honorable, and I had to pull back from doing that. But the lessons that I learned about risk equals reward, and that it doesn't really matter how smart you are, how persistent you are, good habits are important, but really what matters more than anything else is risk versus reward. So Colleen and I said,
well, I don't want to disrail our investment talk, but I definitely want to come back at some point and talk about that AI development because it's becoming even bigger nowadays, and I've got some things I've looked into. Yeah. So we'll shelve that, put it on our 3-page list, 4-page list, and we'll come back to that someday. So, okay, go on. I want to hear some more about what you've been doing with investing.
So what Colleen and I decided to do, you know, we both have savings in our 401ks, and hers is wonderfully stably kind of conservatively invested. And so I said, okay, keep that where it is. And by you being conservative and having kind of a guaranteed rate of return, I can do more. I can take on more risk. And not in a wildcat way. I didn't want to go for, you know, I don't know, uranium futures and that kind of stuff. But I knew that there were ways of pursuing the market so you take on things that have a higher volatility. And if the market is good, you can get bigger rewards. I have always been very impressed with a company called The Motley Fool. They're very good about taking a lot of investing information about various different companies and kind of distilling it down so you can more easily digest a lot of choices to be made and hopefully make some good winners. They have had good winners over the course of time. They were into Amazon early, Netflix early, and stayed with it. One of the things I like about them is that there's two big schools, if you will, of investing. There's fundamentalists that look at the qualities of a company. How well run is it? What does the balance sheet look like, et cetera, et cetera? And there's quantitative people that don't really care about what the company does or what product it makes, but they look at the trajectory of its stock price over the course of time, and they use statistics and statistical methods, artificial intelligence, et cetera, to see patterns in that. So Motley Fool is really good at the fundamental analysis. They pick out great companies, and I subscribed to one of their services, the Stock Advisor, and started to take, you know, my stake, if you will, and invest in various different companies. And I was doing really well. I was probably making 30% at a time that the market was making about 18. And always what you're trying to do is not only are you making money, but how are you making money compared to the market? If you diversify, just buy an index fund that has all the companies in the market, like the S&P 500, it's the lowest risk way to go. But if the market is doing well, you're still making good money. I was trying to beat the market, and that's what The Motley Fool also does, is kind of compare. How are you doing compared to the market? So I started off with relatively conventional stock picks, and then they had an opportunity to go into what they call their blast off portfolio. That what they their best guess for the next 3 to 5 years, what companies have a really good chance of not just doing 30%, but doubling or tripling or five-tupling in value, if you will. And I thought I had come to trust them enough, and I had enough success that I bought into that. And so I shifted some of my investments around to embrace those. And at this point, I've made, since January of 2019, 77%. That's pretty good.
Wow.
You know what I mean? When I was doing my AI-based stuff called Gambit, I was making 42%. And 42, life, the universe, and everything, you know, a great number. And I really thought that was just like walking down the street yelling, look at what I'm doing, how many, and not having to do any of that more complex, et cetera, stuff, I'm actually doing very well in the market. Having said that, what I also became aware of is, now that I've made some money, let's hold on to it. And so I investigated. I like to use what are called trailing stops. It's a way of saying, you know, based on stock price, how much would you let something drop before you actually say, okay, there's a big market downturn happening, and I don't want to follow it all the way down. Some part of being a good investor is not only holding on for the long term, but if you can avoid a few of the worst trenches and then buy back in when the market goes back up, or buy back in at a lower stock price, you're kind of buying things on sale. It's a reasonable posture to take. I've read in a number of investment books that the usual 20 to 25% trailing stop is a good idea. I discovered a company called Tradesmith that actually does a little more sophisticated version of trailing stops, and that uses a volatility quotient that lets you know, based on a company's volatility, where you should set that. Not a blanket 20%, say, but somewhere between 20 and 50, so that you won't bail out of stocks before they have a small decrease and then a big rise. It kind of gives you a smarter way of doing that. So that's kind of how I currently am, is I have money in companies that I really believe in, and at this point I'm in about 40 companies, and have the trailing stops to protect me, if you will. You know, if I got a little bit of an insurance policy. Another thing they talk about doing for investing is, you know, kind of invest in what you know. Way back when they had, you know, investment clubs, the Potato Society, what was it called? You know, a couple of books that came out where even just a neighborhood club can make good money if they don't go with, I don't know, I don't understand IBM, but I understand Walmart. I shop there every week. So I know.
You should have invested in that one fruit company back in the 80s, Apple.
Yeah, exactly, like that. So what I found the most persuasive in a way that I can understand and explain to others is I'm into a lot of tech stocks. So in a way, kind of, I compare myself to the NASDAQ index because a lot of the tech stocks are traded on the over-the-counter market compared to either of the big exchanges. And so the Dow index or the S&P 500 index are a reasonable thing to compare yourself to, but NASDAQ is even more appropriate. And so I'm heavily into tech. I'm heavily into med tech. You know, I think that the world is creating miracles in terms of how we're able to solve certain diseases. Here's hoping we are able to apply some of that brilliance to what's going on with coronavirus and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm very pleased with, and some part of me, I don't know, geekery to me sometimes seems to go with, it isn't only about following the data. It's that once you know about things, you kind of have to act both good and bad. And so I don't want to be in companies that are making good money, but are invested in vice or are invested in let's despoil the planet or whatever else it might be. You know, so I kind of try to avoid companies that they're chicanerous. I don't know, for instance,
today's word, boys and girls.
Well, this is a blanket statement, and I don't think it's like ultra patriotic and jingoistic, but the standards for GAAP, for generally accepted accounting principles, are really strong here in the United States and Europe. They're not so strong for some of the Pacific Rim, especially China, especially down in South America.
Right.
And so even if stocks are looking like they're doing well, I have kind of a little extra degree of suspicion about anything that's going on coming out of China, because I think that their standards are not as high for full disclosure of how they do business and what their sales really are and stuff like that.
This is not investing, but just something similar with China. I know I like to shop at Aldi's. They seem to have a good philosophy of healthy foods and all that, and they have a good price on salmon. Well, I found out that most of their salmon actually comes from China, and China rebranded several different types of fish in the salmon category. So you're not even really getting salmon. You're getting some other fish that they decided to call salmon arbitrarily. I can see that point of being careful with that.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I don't look for bad information about things. And yet when you are confronted with it, once you know that, at one point they were sending various different medicines to the United States, and this is not all of China, of course, but various different companies over there have been more unscrupulous than others. And so you really want to avoid, I don't want getting any supplement from China because the standards for purity are not as good. I don't want to get any, but there's various different things about all the good protections that we have in place here in terms of the FDA or medical practice or quality of materials, or like you just said, you know, the taxonomic classification of fish shouldn't shift because you decide you wanted to sell something, you just call it salmon. So
I must say, China, I know, is buying and owning and running a lot of movie production companies now. If you look up some of the movies and the companies, there's a very large majority that are Chinese.
Interesting.
They're doing a damn good job in that area, let me tell you. The funny thing is, though, over there, they seem, from what I've heard, they've seemed to have so much pirating that, like, movies don't make money over there. So it's kind of this weird thing. They're totally investing in companies make money off of us.
Yeah, they go to the markets where they know there are protections because they kind of can't count on their own, maybe. That's interesting. It's wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I maybe I'll look into that more. That's something to talk about another day. So, your thing, what you went to this week, the Motley Fool Fest.
Exactly. Motley Fool has a convention they do every year called Fool Fest. They're based out of maybe like Western Virginia. I'm trying to think where in Virginia, but usually they have, you know, a lot of people have been with the Fool for a long time and they're real big fans. And so they have people gather at their, at a convention center near their offices, and they do a full day of presentations about, hey, what market trends do we see? You know, what's the right way to be a smart investor? What they have. So in this case, and because they're relatively well known and have some influence, they have great speakers. They had Steven Pinker, you know, who wrote Enlightenment Now and How the Mind Works. They had Mark Cuban, who, you know, a very savvy investor and company runner. They had Zuckerberg. I'm sorry, I don't remember her first name. Maybe Vicky, you know, who they really had great quality speakers from outside the industry, but that are involved. And then also they had all kinds of great breakout sessions about, if you're interested in driverless cars, here's some companies you might be interested in. How about AI? How about the 5G technology coming up that's going to make our networks all the faster and more blankety, if you will. And so,
well, there's another topic for
exactly, but that for like I was at my desk, and of course because they couldn't physically do it this year for fear that hey, we all got together and learned investment news, and then we all got coronavirus. And so,
right.
But they did it. They handled it very, very well. Only one or two technical glitches for the volume of people they must have had on simulcast and stuff like that. And so a deep immersion from like 10 till 5 of, question and answer and these breakout sessions and stuff. And I took like 25 pages of notes. Oh, good Lord. I just betrayed. I still write. I still, do things on paper. And yet I've discovered that that's a really good way for me to remember things, that you're not only hearing it, but the act of writing it down and distilling it while you're writing it kind of puts it holographically in different places in your brain. And it sticks more. You know what I mean?
Yes. So we'll put that down for another day. Learning,
exactly.
Because that's something I've been involved with, and how different people learn. And yes, hearing it, writing it down, and then within like a day rereading it, you got like 79%.
Exactly that it really does, good reinforcement and stuff. And I've discovered that writing works better than typing does for me. That there's something different about the individual letters of typing versus the writing, where it's word groups and the flow of it, that it works much better. So I'm sure there's a scientific study that we can pop into that shows that. But from my own personal experience, I found something that works. I tried otherwise, it didn't work as well. And so I just, I got to make sure I have a pad of paper, even in this era of Zoom communications and everything's computerized. So
let me ask, because I know some people that for a while back in the 90s, day trading was like the hot thing. Oh, I'm a day trader. And they sat in front of 5 computer screens and watched and like bought this, sold this, bought that, and like constantly all day long. What do you do? Because it doesn't sound like you're like sitting in front of
exactly.
it.
Exactly. It's not that at all. Day trading is very much quantitative, and it really does make use of, during the course of a day, there's always, you'll see on everybody reports an open, a high, low, and a close. And day traders try to take advantage of all the interstitial movements, between those various different things, that when they see patterns where something is going to, with some degree of probability, go up or go down, they buy in real quick and get out real quick. They really don't try, they don't care about what the company, again, is or does. They care about the movement of that company's price. And there's companies, because they're more volatile, they create more opportunities for doing that. But boy, it's an incredibly tense life. You are betting a certain amount of money again and again, and you're making, micro dollars. You're not trying to make, 77%. You're trying to make that little 0.07%, but make that again and again. And depending on the size of your bet, it can turn into money. But it's my overall philosophy way back when I started was, what do I do for a living? I'm a computer software designer and developer. I do architecture. I want to know enough about the market, about how it works, but I don't need a second job to become an actual, investment analyst and stuff like that. So I bought the index to buy the market. And in fact, FIRE, a very cool organization that's about, financial independence, retire early. They talk much about this, that the best way to get rich is to invest regularly, buy into those index funds or ETFs, and not try to beat the market. Just let the market work for you. Let the market, the time value of money, work for you. So back to what I really don't do any day trading at all. I'm in with that at least 3 to 5 year horizon. And frankly, I don't know that I ever intend to be out of the market. Even as we go into retirement, there's a certain weighting that you want to give to how much you have in conservative versus more aggressive investments. But Colleen and I kind of already have in the split between what we have in our various portfolios. And so because I like doing it, because I like learning about these companies and kind of like knowing which way the world is heading. And so where I spend my time is not looking for those price manipulations. It's learning about companies and learning which ones I think are good bets and sizing them. You know what I mean? Doing relative portfolio sizing so that Amazon's a better bet than Pinterest or whatever else it might be. And actually, if you're trying to make money, it's exactly the opposite, that really big established companies will make that guaranteed good rate. But if you're looking to make a little bit more, you have to take on something that's a little bit more risky. And so the Pinterest and the Etsy and the Alibris and things that kind of compete in areas that Amazon's already very strong, if they do well, they'll do multiply well instead of that wonderful steady curve upwards that Amazon has.
Right.
You know what I mean? So.
So, I mean, like I said, I got just a small little bit of investment. Would you say it'd be advantageous if I had like $1,000, go check out Motley Fool, find a couple that they recommend putting that money in, and then just once a month, every other week, putting some more money in, checking it? How often do you change those types of things?
What I have done is only when there was a big movement on my part, like to go to the Blastoff portfolio, did I change what I own. Otherwise, I have many of the things that I bought when I very first started. You know, I bought into Apple, I bought into Okta, bought into Match.com, et cetera, et cetera. Depending on how much money you have, a better way might be to buy, like if you have a certain, I only think how to say this. If you are willing to do the work, a little bit of work to find out which companies you like, that's a good way to go. If what you want to do is buy a certain segment of the market, like tech really seems to have been in the course of these last two years, there's any number of ways you could look at it. Tech is continually on the up with the way the world is changing, the creation of intellectual property, etc., compared to any number of big sectors like energy, which is really in the doghouse, or manufacturing, retail goods. There's goods and bad companies in each of those, but as a sector, more or less, you don't want to be in energy right now. You know, the way the world is shifting towards alternative energy, but the way that certain companies still want to really keep a grip on oil and coal.
Right.
Did I just do a spoonerism there? Oil and coal. Oil and coil. I'll have to remember that. That's pretty funny. That might be a wise way to go. If you believe in tech, as I do, and as I've had proven to me, buying what's called an ETF, an exchange-traded fund that specializes in technology, would be a good way to buy into a whole bunch of possibilities of success. And I guess what we need to do, by the way, is, you know, Relentless Geekery are not indeed stock analysts, and we are not here to give you financial advice,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera. So I know we're talking about some very specific things, but it really is meant to be, you know, at the hobbyist level still. I don't have licenses to do this. I'm not licensed to give anybody advice. And so
this is
Al's experience. And if you think Al's experience is interesting, then maybe. But otherwise, good Lord, I'm not at all saying this is a guaranteed win. And in fact, the first thing you say when you're talking about investing is you always should say past results do not necessarily lead to future results. You know what I mean?
Right. So. I may want to look at it. I may want to sell my railroading shares.
It's like that.
I'm not sure.
The best buggy whip maker is no longer doing.
Yeah. My blacksmith said I should buy into his company. Which actually, that could be a rant topic someday,
right.
Too. I've got something I point out to people and they look at me blankly. But another topic, I'll put it down.
So in the overall Fool Fest is cool, is what I'm trying to say.
It was
exactly.
Cool.
It was worth the entire, you know, like there's so many things that attract our attention nowadays that it's not, what I love doing is it's not only it was worth an entire day, but once in a while, it's really cool to go back to school. You know what I mean? That instead of living a life where there's 1,000 interruptions and you get to choose which ones of those you'll let distract you, but once in a while, it's good to say, put all that aside and just go listen to smart people. Go learn deeply about a certain subject. So I still love going to tech conferences. And, you know, again, in the age of coronavirus, I don't know when they're going to start up, but I used to go to Macworld every year because it was just cool to see what Apple was doing, what all of Apple's, you know, the universe of companies surrounding them. And I'm pretty sure there are still Android Fests and CES, and I just like Mensa has a thing called Colloquia, you know, where they focus on a certain topic, and I've had a great time at the one on cosmology, the one on weather, you know what I mean? You get a whole bunch of good speakers in the course of the day, and you'll learn a ton just by paying attention. And I like that.
Right. You won't this year, though. But
not this year. That's right. Mensa, the annual gathering, like many other things, has been postponed. You know what I mean? You just can't take the risk of that many people in an enclosed space
Because someone will run into trouble and then want to sue, and it'll ruin everything. You can't take that chance. But Weem, at the moment, is still on.
Exactly. Halloween, the big one in Chicago. We hope by end of October there will be some breakthrough in terms of either a cure or something that really does seem to help symptoms, maybe even a vaccine, though that's a long shot because vaccines just take longer to develop and to create enough doses to get out there. But
plus, just because it doesn't kill you today, what if you start developing symptoms in a month? That that needs some time.
Exactly. And unfortunately, Mesa, like any other group of people, it's the weakest link theory, right? That unless everybody there agrees to really good protocol in terms of wearing masks, and not to be weird, a lot of these gatherings is the joy of breaking bread, the joy of sitting at a table and having some food together and having a nice conversation. And that isn't that easy with a mask on, is it?
Bowls of gummy bears that everybody reaches into.
Exactly. Yeah. That's, Colleen and I need to put up a little, tombstone in our yard that says, rest in peace buffets. You know what I mean? We've always loved that silly variety of just, I can go there and try 50 different things. Well, when are buffets going to be able to make a comeback in this era of, it's not just a snot screen anymore. It's like everybody has to be in a radiation suit in order to be.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is, because I've been writing some, if you want to write a book, you can set it in early 2020 and back, and people will be like, wow, that's like so old fashioned because they're shaking hands and they're all eating at a restaurant. It'll date the story.
That's so true. You have written a number of books, and I think you, by setting them in certain times and places, you have those considerations, care to go into that? How did you pick where you wanted to live in your book?
Well, because my mind goes towards fantasy. I've read fantasy, played D&D, live fantasy. That actually makes it easier because I've only got one series right now that's actually, you might consider, modern urban.
Okay.
And I'm still working on it. So the rest of the stuff, is in fantasy. So you can do almost anything. And it doesn't, not affected by the real world.
Got it. Exactly. So the town magician is the one you're talking about, your main fantasy one, and then the urban is other. Okay.
Yeah. The urban one is the Oddish Questers, the one I'm basing off my kids and made it like a Scooby-Doo mystery.
Well, how cool is that? Okay.
So that'll be coming. Mm-hmm. It's pretty fun. I enjoy that. In fact, I was just talking last night. I had another series, but I hadn't gotten the hook for it. It just has been stewing in my head, and I got the hook and sat down and wrote off like a 1,000-word intro.
Fantastic.
And let Gina read it. And she's like, oh yeah, I'd love to read this. This sounds great. I'm like, cool. Now I got it. Now I'm like, oh man, I got to finish this other series so I can get the new one. I love The Town Magician, but that's something we should talk about, books and stuff at some time. But you get to the point where you're like, okay, I need a break. I'm tired of these characters. But you also don't want to stop in the middle of a 4-book series or something like that. So it gets rough.
I know a couple authors that decide to do that, though, that they give themselves different series and settings so that they can re-energize themselves by, instead of just plowing through something and having it kind of show in the work that they're not themselves that interested in it, by them kind of alternating or popping amongst various different things, they're working on whatever is the most stimulating to them at the time, and then they don't wear themselves out.
Like Bill, he's got how many series? So the Star Carrier, he can write book 10 or whatever he's up to, but then go over to the Dark Andromeda stuff and write book 3.
Exactly.
And it works because there's enough back catalog. When you only got one thing out, you kind of got to keep going with
to establish the trilogy or whatever. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, very much.
We're also blessed because you have smart, quirky kids, and they're automatically characters. Yes. You know what I mean? I can see.
Oh my God.
As long as you don't Romane Clefet, is that how you say it? So much that they're like, hey, you can't, betray family secrets,
Right. Well, I've talked to all of them and said, hey, is anybody upset about this? And they haven't cared yet. So we'll see. But I put up on the website a Young Oddish Questers series, and I'm doing it as a chapter serial. So there's 6 chapters available on the website now.
Cool.
And it's all of them when they were young and how they got together and their first adventure together.
Interesting.
So it's interesting because the world building just keeps coming naturally. It's not our world exactly, at least not the reality of the kids. it's our world, but the reality of the kids is a different reality, I guess you could say. It's fun. So we'll see. I don't know.
Serializing is a whole different thing, too. I mean, that's interesting. That's kind of like writing it. You know, you want to have a cliffhanger ending, or you want to, you have to have like known, instead of a river novel where it just kind of runs, and even from book to book, you're really creating like individual things that are still each worth reading, but enough of a linkage that people want to continue, you know? So
I hope so.
Very good.
So, okay. Well, here, you got anything more on the investing front?
Not really. Comments? Let's see. Right. You know, right now I intend to do, keep doing what I've been doing. I regularly read Motley Fool. I look for what they're most recommending. Some things I don't buy into because I don't have as much confidence in retail as I do in tech. But, and so what I end up doing in order to take my block of money and what it's made, I cannibalize like the lowest things that, you know, I have things that are making anywhere between 200% and negative 20%.
Wow.
You know, so I really do have something, a couple of things that have crippled. It's an amazing. But Teladoc is particularly the company, Teladoc and Okta, drop some good names, but Teladoc is perfect for its time. It's a place that allows remote doctoring. You know what I mean? It's one of the ones where instead of having to go to the doctor's office, you can actually have a consultation with a physician and they collect information, they can do prescriptions, all that kind of stuff. In this era of not wanting to have any more human contact than you have to, it has exploded, it has boomed. And the fundamentals of the company are such that it's not only because of coronavirus, it's that this is just becoming a good play overall. As we get more concentrated to cities, but people outside the cities still need doctoring, hospitals might be closing. You know, you don't want to drive 120 miles to get to the nearest doctor. This is going to be enabling, and just like they also have ISRG, Intuitive Surgical, has what they call the Da Vinci machines. They're places, they're machines that allow for remote surgery. So by having this in a hospital, you can actually don't have to have a skilled surgeon of all the various different specialties that surgeons have. You know, so they're doing very well on a slower pace than Teladoc, but they, I don't know. So those are, it's fun to tell these stories because there's a great quote from, let's see, I think William Gibbons that said, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And that's so like much that. How the markets work is that there's often great ideas that have been around for 5, 10, 20 years, but it takes a while to work its way up and down in society, across geography, country to country. Right. And if you can see those trends, see those parades and get in front of them, that's a good way to make money. You know the world's going to want more and more nanotechnology, more and more, you know what I mean, artificial intelligence, and then find the companies that definitely are executing well on that. You know, so.
Right. We definitely are living in a Star Trek world.
Yeah. So, like I said, to go back to, I cannibalize small portions of, you know, I've got $4,000 in this stock. I'm going to take $1,000 out of it to make a $1,000 bet on something that I'm curious about. And then depending on how those things go, I don't usually shuffle a lot between various different things. It's more kind of like playing with the house's money. If a company is doing well but hasn't made as much as the ones that are doing great, I will actually say, okay, I'll take a little bit out of what you've made me and use it for another bet. And so that's kind of how I got to be 40 companies. Usually you need to have maybe like 18 to 20 to give yourself good diversification. And that's not really true because if you're too much in the tech sector, it's not truly diversified. But the more bets you have, the less chance you have of they all crash, they all go down.
Right.
And really out of all the ones, even though I'm down 20% in one of them, nothing has gone to negative 50, negative 80. There's nothing that's going to, you know, that I have bought into that looks like it's actually going to just crash and burn. So I wait for those things to recover as opposed to, oh God, it's dying, I better get out. You know what I mean? You don't want to do the buy low, sell high. You don't want to do the opposite, which is so many people do out of emotion. You know what I mean?
Right.
Anyway. So
I'm going to go check out what my investments and portfolio look like, maybe get a little more into it. I mean, it can't hurt, you know a little bit more.
And this is kind of corny, but I every day I give Colleen a little bit the box score. You know what I mean? Hey, I'm up, you know, $1,700 today. And it's not because I went out and I dug a ditch and the strength of my back. It's so nice to have your smarts working for you. that I made some good decisions, right. And then I know these things about how the market works. And then to see it come true, it's kind of like you plant a flower, and then when it blooms, it's like, well, everything went just right. Isn't that beautiful? Right. So far, so good.
Well, good, yeah, good. Yeah. Okay, let's switch gears, change topics. Something I brought up, I wanted to talk to you about, get some feedback on. Yes, comic books. I mean, how big a switch there? Investing to comic books. And people invest in comic books still today. People want to buy the best ones and stuff. But so catch up people a little bit about what's going on in the comic world. So with the coronavirus, it affected everybody, and comics was not a necessity. So pretty much all the comic stores were shut down. Well, the companies were also shut down. The printing company and like Marvel DC producing the comics, even though they could keep producing because a lot of those people work from home, exactly. It didn't affect that, but there was nowhere for the books to go, nowhere to print it, nowhere to ship it. So everything kind of got frozen for quite a while, and it was very volatile because comics are not a high return, big money business. They work on very slim margins at times. So the interesting thing is there's a distributor called Diamond Distributor, and they are essentially a monopoly. Like 99% of all comic books ship through Diamond to all the different
companies. Steve Jeffy has built an amazing empire. Exactly.
Okay. Yes. I have a personal story about Diamond, actually a friend's personal story I could tell you in a moment. But the thing is now things are starting to go back, and DC Comics, who, if you know about comics, is one of the two big ones that run most of the industry, they decided to completely cut ties with Diamond and start shipping comics through these other distributors. Totally upset the whole chain. Now, we talked a little bit about, you know, there's a monopoly there. There's some good and bad in the comic industry with that. The good thing is Diamond got everything pretty much on time. So they were so big, they could order lots of stuff to distribute out. And there are instances where a comic book company was like, look, or a comic book store, I'm sorry, was like, hey, look, I'm not doing so well this month. Can I pay you later? And Diamond's like, yeah, sure. Here's your books. Pay us later. And they actually helped the businesses stay afloat, which makes sense because if the business is closed, they're not.
They want that outlet to be available to them, but then they started to take on a little bit of the risk of that outlet too. Okay.
Right. But, you know, again, like you said, all eggs in one basket make it kind of risky. Mm-hmm. So during the whole shutdown, DC, for whatever reason, wanted to start shipping comics before everything opened back up, which made a lot of people mad. They're like, look, I can't have people come and buy. What am I going to do?
Yeah, just have stack up, you know what I mean? And then binge and reading versus binge watching when the stores finally reopen or something like that.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So what DC did was they contracted with, I believe it was Midtown Comics, which is one of the really big retail resellers. Okay. They have tons of back issues, et cetera. They contracted with them and said, hey, we'll send our books to you. You become our distributor. So I have a local comic book company here. They were basically told, if you want this week's DC Comics, get a hold of Midtown to make your order. Well, here's the problem. Midtown is really a competitor to my local comic book store. So they were supposed to order the books from their competitor. Right. Worse yet, Midtown wanted the list of all their regular customers who had pools. If you don't know what a pool is, it's when the shop owner has a list of the comics I want, and he'll put them aside for me, so I'm guaranteed to get them.
And in good condition instead of being plowed through on the stand and stuff like that. That's right. Okay.
And Midtown wanted that list from all the comic shop owners before they would let them order. So,
which seems a little manipulative, you know what I mean? That's abusing your power. Okay.
Right. So now the problem is, besides that, the comic stores are like, wait a second. If there's a hot comic coming out and I need 100 of them, you might say, well, I'm only giving you 10 because, you know, Midtown wants to keep all the comics that are going to be worth money to sell themselves. And if I'm incorrect saying Midtown, I believe that was it. But if I'm incorrect in that and then somebody corrects me, that's fine. I apologize.
Somehow in my mind, I had Mile High instead of Midtown. Maybe that's it. But anyway, it is some big company, like you said, that is a very well-established retailer. But now they've put themselves in the middle. Okay.
So now DC has totally severed ties with Diamond completely. Okay. They're not using them at all. And it's caused a big uproar. And there's a lot of comic shop people upset. And people are wondering if they'll go get their comics. And what'll probably happen is nowhere nearly as big a problem as everyone thinks it is. It's probably what'll end up in the end. But it's just such a big shakeup. And I find it interesting that DC at this time, during the coronavirus, they shut everything down, but they kind of said, well, we're going to ship stuff anyway. So people like my son are like, oh my God, there's this big comic coming out and I'm not going to get it. How am I going to get it? Or I'm missing a comic, you know? So it sounds like a minor problem to most people, but it's something he's really, enjoys.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting situation to say the least.
So honestly, I can very much understand it. As you know, I'm a longtime comic book reader and collector. And that, the idea of, wow, I already have 170 issues of Daredevil, and now I'm going to have to worry about I'm going to get a break in my collection because of market manipulation. So various different people that don't have their main thrust is, hey, get comic books into hands. It's more, they want a different share. They want a different distribution,
right,
whatever else it might be. That's very disconcerting. And especially, it's not that comic books are for kids. They haven't been for a long time. They're for adults. But it's a relatively innocent hobby. And so when we had problems with Marvel, did a similar thing like 20 years ago with Heroes World, where they also broke away and tried to do different distribution, and it caused disruption. And most people were either indifferent or they were like, why would you do that without knowing that your solution was going to be just as good or better than it wasn't? You improved upon the market. You actually just kind of did it because you got greedy or any number of other factors. I don't mean to make so it isn't a matter of good and evil, which is what comic book people would want to make it. You know what I mean?
Well, somebody's going to write a story that's this whole thing, I'm sure.
So I'm curious, I guess, as to, I know that they've also been, so a whole bunch of thoughts. I know that they had an attempt to return to comic books being a newsstand type thing. For a long time, they've mostly been bought, like 90%, by specialty shops instead of in the grocery stores and the other places they used to be. But was it DC that did the experimentation with comic racks in Walmart, that they actually had like 6, 8, 10 titles? And so maybe, kind of inspired by that, they kind of said, well, if we really do have a good deal with Walmart, that's as big a distribution network as almost all the specialty comics combined. Especially comic shops combined. And so maybe that's one of the things, is they're investigating different stuff. I know one of the things that I've read from, I read some comic industry, trade zines, if you will, that comic books haven't been a viable business for a long time. The reason that they exist is to create the characters and the ongoing stories so that you have all of the merchandising, all the action figures, all the movie rights, all the television shows, and that they're kind of like not the farm team. That's not an apt analogy, but they keep supplying the content that will make big money because Avengers was a $1 billion movie and things like that, so.
And along with that, that's the same, that's the same philosophy as like cartoons. We no longer have Saturday morning cartoons because cartoons weren't making money. The only way cartoons made money in these later days was by having the action figures, by having the board game, the video game.
Exactly, all the spinoffs.
And they weren't. Yeah, they weren't doing that. So we no longer have Saturday morning cartoons, which is sad. And there are cartoons that have come out that I've been like, oh, that looks interesting. Well, it comes out for a season and it ends on a cliffhanger. And they're like, yeah, we're not renewing it because we didn't make enough money on the toys.
Yes.
So it's like, it hurts for the story standpoint. It hurts because you like to see those stories and watch them. And there are some really good adult type cartoons. In fact, I sat down with my stepson and we went back to the 90s version of The Tick and watched that cartoon.
Ben
and
Edlund.
I was laughing at it. Yeah, it was great. The comics industry, I mean, come on, the comics, they cost a lot. They're like $4 and $5. But the comic store only makes a little bit. The distributor only makes a little bit. Then Diamond or whoever is making a little bit along with DC and then the artist. So everybody makes just that little bit along the way. The big money was in the resale. So, if a comic got, there's comics that have come out and the day I pick it up, it's already worth $50 if I didn't get it that day. So I can see how people would be upset if whoever Midtown Mile High or whatever, whoever is actually starting to handle that, if they resell these comics, if they say, well, we know Batman versus the Joker 2000 is going to be worth $100. We're going to keep as many of these as possible. And then it makes it even scarcer, so they could even raise the price more. I could see how that could be a problem for people.
I'll tell you, when I was still buying comics, and a lot of them, I did it all through the mail. I worked with a company called M&M Distributors that used to be out of Chicago, but then moved to Texas. But I can't, you know, shout out to them. It's kind of funny. One of the things I like to do in the podcast, like, it's fun to do some name checking and that kind of thing.
Right.
They were absolutely honorable in terms of, I always got everything I ordered. So far as I could tell, whatever speculation they might have been doing was totally separate from the orders that they were taking from all their various different customers. I never got shorted anything because, ooh, low availability. No, they worked extra hard. And in fact, not only for that month, they would keep track of if something was delayed that had been solicited, you would eventually get it 6 months later when the artist got his act together or the company finally, you know, did put it out somehow. So I really like the place. I guess that's a way of finding out who's kind of honorable and who's not, is who's going to do those practices, you know?
And that's funny you say that, because I used to actually buy and sell and deal with Magic the Gathering trading or the game cards. And I was a reseller shop. I could order bulk and get huge quantities. They came out with a set called The Vault, which took some, it was the dragons, and it took some of the best dragons through all of Magic up to that time, reprinted them, put them in this package, nice looking leather case,
wow,
all that.
Okay.
And I had like 5-6 people that ordered some off me. They said, oh yeah, we'll take that. Well, it was a good deal for me because I was getting it for like $45 and selling it for 80. Okay. So 5 or 6 of those, that's a good day.
Sorry about this.
When the shipment came in, I opened it up and I've got 3 of those in there. And I get a hold of them and I'm like, hey, what's going on?
I ordered 8
of these. They said, oh, we don't think you're big enough, so we only gave you 3.
They allocated is the term they use for it. We screwed you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, guess who that distributor was?
Oh,
Diamond.
No. Oh, yeah. Man.
So, you know, and back, and this is kind of funny too, about 10 years ago, I had a friend, him and another guy took, like, quit work, and they were developing their own comic book. They had like 6 issues done. They wanted to show they could do it. They had the whole story, you know, good, interesting comic. They tried to get DC or Marvel. Neither were interested, but they would be able to distribute it themselves. But Diamond had to approve it to distribute it. And Diamond held the book and kept, you know, saying, well, we'll see for like 1.5 years. And then they said, no, we don't want to distribute it.
That's
so
terrible.
It killed it.
Exactly. The fact that, I mean, a whole different topic that we can't get into now, but there's, you know, just understanding monopoly and how that really doesn't lend itself towards any of the
right
quality of life that you want in a capitalist society. And especially when you hear people talk about the joys of capitalism while they're doing everything behind the scenes to do everything anti-capitalist that they can, it's enraging. You know what I mean? So
right.
It might be that it's time for Diamond to really have some difficulties and maybe die. And in the creative destruction, something new and better will emerge, because it sounds
right.
like they have been kind of abusing their position, their power for a while.
Right.
So,
I would hope so, but I'm wondering how this has affected digital comics. I know DC, Colin told me DC has a habit that, or a policy, that when they come out with a trade paperback, they basically almost donate it to all the libraries around, all the big libraries around the country. Because then when you go into your library, you will see 5,000 DC trade
and
paperbacks.
And make that your habit.
So what do you
Yes,
gonna,
make that your universe.
Yes,
okay.
You know? That's what Apple did with Macs in the schools back in the 80s, you know? So I don't think Marvel does that. I think Marvel sells them like normal.
Yeah.
But I think DC does what they can. So I wonder what it's going to do for digital. Cause I know my stepson, Jason, likes to read trade paperbacks digitally.
Okay.
That's the only way he really enjoys comics.
Yeah.
He doesn't like single issues. He doesn't like holding the paper. He wants to flip through it on the iPad.
Interesting.
Well, that's fine. I wonder during this pandemic if others have started to do that. It's interesting. Maybe I'll follow up with that, find out a little more what's going on. And then that'll change, because if all the comics are digital, you don't have the resell, right. But they also can, you can sell them anytime, forever. Exactly.
There's a whole great book called The Long Tail about all of this, the shift towards the different kinds of merchandising that we're going to see, and that when things are available forever, you kind of give up scarcity, but you get different problems. You know what I mean? That then there's no sense of urgency to read something if it's always going to be out there for you to do it. Anyway, right. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's the other aspect then, you know, and we talked about this. In fact, that was something we said we were going to talk about. Our kids, you and I were talking about ELP and Carnival No. 9,
right, exactly.
And how we like to set it on a stereo and put the needle on, and then you got the speaker.
Whenever I set up my stereo in a new place, that's always been my opening song. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Exactly. So,
and it's such a great song, but we were talking about, and this goes right along with what we were just talking about with the comics, how when I got an album, I had to save for it. I had to drive to the store to pick up that album. And I knew there may not be another printing, or if it was, it may be a long time. So I had to make sure to get a copy of that album. And then I listened to that album. Man, I wore out cassette tapes. You don't do that nowadays. But our kids can get anything they want immediately, but they have no ownership of it, and they don't have that bond like we do.
Yeah. And I think there are definitely advantages and disadvantages. You know what I mean? I've always liked reading the liner notes and finding out who made music. And then when you see that name on another album, it's like, oh, you know, Steve Hackett also played over here. He's got solo stuff. I'm going to go listen to that. It was a great engine of discovery for me to be able to say, oh, Phil Collins is playing over here and Bill Bruford is over here and that kind of stuff. And that, the full experience, I guess, of listening to, you know, first album sides, then entire CDs, and like reading the lyrics, reading the liner notes and that kind of stuff. It seems that that's gotten a little bit fragmented, that we're back to a singles world. And I always liked the long form instead of the singles world, even when both singles and LPs were available. But having said that, there's really cool things about people being able to put together their own playlists. You know, the fact that they don't have to buy, and there's any number of albums that were like, wow, two good songs and maybe eight flatter ones. You know, it was very uncommon to have a perfect album that everything on it was good. And nowadays, they really can kind of curate their own collection and put together their own playlist so that it's high quality, or they're looking for, this is my energy music, and this is my mellowing out music, and this is my driving music. Right. And so I see that there's trade-offs, I guess, you know, for the fragmentation lends itself to both good and bad, something like that.
And it's just that the songs, if you bought an album, I'm thinking of Rush, you know, back in the day, they didn't have theme albums, but there was a definite, each album had its own feel to it. It had its own way of speaking to you, I guess. And some albums, lots of hits, like the Exit Stage Left. Oh, that was live. But it had... like everything was a hit on it. But then there are other albums that didn't have quite all hits, but they all went together as a whole unit.
Moving Pictures, well, for now, instance, was a lot of hits. And
yes, Moving Pictures. Thank you. That's what I was thinking of. And now, though, the kids get their music, but it's streamed, or they get on YouTube or whatever. So there's no cohesive album. They jump around, and artists can't come out with something that is not a hit. Because if they release something that's not an instant hit, nobody's go pick it and listen to it, because they don't listen to the whole album.
So we're down to everything has to be individually of quality instead of being able to put a body of work out there, if you will. Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And I don't know. I've talked to a couple other people. Like I have another author friend. He's talked about, he's got like over 1,000 CDs. He's got a case with 1,000 CDs sitting there. He's like, but I've ripped them all to MP3. They're all on my phone right now. He's like, I have that connection to them from back in the day, but I don't listen to the CDs themselves. You know, I'm the same way. That's I've exactly got a whole drive. I put all my ripped CDs onto, and cassette tapes. There's hardcore. I took my cassette tapes and I ripped them to MP3s, and I took some LPs and ripped them to MP3s.
Wow. See, when I tried doing that with an LP and had to do all of the data entry, because instead of having CDDB, give you the names of the tracks based on that digital fingerprint, it really was, wow, only the things that have never come out only I have
right.
foot lockers of albums. I mean, I was a music listener for a long time. So in college, everything was LPs. I have foot lockers of albums that have never come back out to play. That I, some of them really have not been done as a CD. And yet I haven't ever bought like the USB turntable. Let me capture that because I know it's a huge job. And I just haven't taken that job on.
It's time consuming. Yeah. here's something. This is pretty funny. Various music programs like a Winamp, they have plugins. I actually saw an LP plugin. So you could put on your favorite music, MP3, but it would add a little bit of hiss and some pops and clicks and stuff as if it was an LP.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. And then they also had a skin for the whole thing. So it looked like some old 60s turntable with the grill and the leather or whatever they had. You can simulate that. But there's nothing like pulling that album out, looking at the album cover, the artwork, unfolding the little
flaps.
Got to
run the dishwasher over it to make sure that, you know, you're the perfect tracking cartridge and don't get let any,
yeah.
No dust, no nicks. You know,
and the horror when you're listening to something, you hear it go, you know, and you're like, don't jump. It's like a cake's in the oven. Don't move.
The souffle of music. There we go.
Right. So, and I think I was telling you, the oddball of the whole group, the 8-track. Mm-hmm. I mean, my sister had an 8-track and I remember listening to that and Don McLean's American Pie, middle of the song, it would pause and go ka-chunk to the next track. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Who wants to buy an 8-track? I can see why they died. But there is one 8-track that I would love to get a hold of. I believe it's Animals.
One, right? Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Floyd. That last time. Exactly.
Yeah, so I might still be looking around every now and then for that one, but it's who knows if I'll ever see one.
I never got into the 8-track thing because my car didn't have an 8-track player; had cassette instead, and that's what I, you know, when I made copies from albums, it was always on the cassette. That's the other besides all the LPs and now the CDs that I have electric cassettes that were my driving music. You know, so
yes, yeah. I have a playlist now that's my summer tunes.
There you go.
First day of summer, play my summer tunes.
What used to be called a mixtape instead of a playlist. Yeah, there are analogies. So anyway.
Yes. Well, I did make my wife a mix CD when we were early on.
You romantic fool. That's wonderful. I bet you she cherishes that. That's wonderful.
She gives me dirty looks because I put things like Weird Al's One More Minute on it. So that may not have been the perfect choice, but
rather to swim naked in a swimming pool. Anyway, and let her know you had a sense of humor, that you weren't just a sop. That's great.
Right. There's actually a newer Weird Al song that's even better. He's like, it's basically, you know, I told you I love you. I let you sleep in before I had you get up and wash my socks. God. You know, it's pretty funny. It's like this clueless guy.
He's had a couple of the unrequited love songs, if you will.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. So.
All right.
All right, Al. Looks like we're coming up on definitely an hour. Any last thoughts for the...
Nope, every time that we come up with good ideas, we're going to add them to the list. And, you know, over the course of years and years and years, we're going to have fun with this, Stephen. Thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So I'll be in touch with you on these tracks. We'll get them, see what you think about some of the music, and we'll get an intro and outro done. And we could probably put the first couple episodes all up at once and point people, because that way they have something more to listen to.
And already now I think with the microphones, the sound quality would be better. You know, I've always believed in show the work, that if you had humble beginnings, it's nice to see that people can see you cared enough to try to make it better, to make the sound quality better, the video, what you talked about. It's just, you know what I mean? It's okay to come from humble and get to good. And so let's work on that.
Right.
Sounds great.
And, you know, we're definitely not a big corporation.
Exactly.
So hopefully we just bring a little enjoyment to people's lives. All right, man. You have a good week. Talk to you later. Bye.
You have been listening to the Relentless Geekery Podcast. Come back next week and join Alan and Steven's conversation on geek topics of the week.